the rabbi of Varsovia would do if he would see me standing next to a Christmas tree talking to a... But I think it's meant to be that way. I like to imitate some of the speakers who start out with a couple jokes to warm myself up, because for no unknown reason to me, I'm nervous. And don't ask me, well, what fellow in the other room says, so many years in this fellowship, you're nervous? I say, yeah. Well, it must be because I really feel that I hope the good Lord gives me something to say that will mean something to somebody. And roses are red. Violets are bluish. If it wouldn't be for Jesus, you would all be Jewish. But not bad. Not bad. It's good. I have a few more little poems to tell you, but they're not funny ones. I'm going to tell you tonight a story about what happened to a little Jewish boy. And it's not the same that the world is celebrating tonight. The birth of a little Jewish boy and what happened to him. That's me. But before I tell you that, I'll tell you what happened to a little Jewish boy in my neighborhood. And his name was Abraham. And his father wouldn't know what to do with him, because he had very bad marks. He was going to a religious school, to one of those Hebrew schools in Winter Park, you know, the high-class Jewish neighborhood, and he was bringing home bad marks. Finally, he met a priest, and the father says to the priest, what should I do with this boy? He said, why don't you try to send him to Catholic school? So Abraham said, maybe it's a good idea, send him to Catholic school, and the kid starts coming home with perfect A's, straight A's, straight A's. One day, the father sits him down in the kitchen and says, hey, Jakey, what happened to you? How come you're doing so well now? He said, you see, Pop, I come into the classroom the first day, and there was a teacher standing at the blackboard, and there was something on the wall, and he says to me, you see, what this is what happened to little Jewish boys if they don't study well. So he studied well. I think enough of making fun of that or whatever it is. The only thing is I want to explain to Jerry. Jerry said it's a nice jacket, so I want to explain to you the origin of the jacket. This jacket was made in Finland. That's what the label says. And this jacket I bought when I was in Israel, and I used American Express. It's a good combination. My name is Leo, and I'm an alcoholic. I don't have to a story for you that is really so outstanding that tops everybody else, and I don't have to do that. I have not spent years and years in institutions and in jails, but I had my bottom, and I have done almost everything a good good zombie alcoholic does with his jobs, with his family, with his life. But I'll have to entwine it with a little bit of other experiences, which is part of my story. As I said, I wasn't born in Bethlehem or Nazareth, so I was there not too long ago. And I found my roots there, by the way. I just was there in September for a month. I found out that I'm a descendant of Jesus Christ, direct. And that makes me feel good, because they told me that's where my family comes from, straight from there. And to tell you the truth, it's amazing. Tonight I watched television. Unfortunately, due to the situation, I think there's as many people here tonight as they are there celebrating Mass, because everyone was scared there. And this is the bad spot and the dark spot in the situation, the way it is the world today. And by the way, before I say anything, I hope that in closing we keep in mind the people that perished in that disaster in the airplane. And among the people that saddens me more than anything when it comes to a holiday is the people that are out drinking and didn't find the doors to AA yet. For them, my heart goes out all the way. I was born in Poland. You heard about this brilliant country. Polish people are brilliant. And I was born in a small town called Lodz, L-O-D-Z. And I was born into a family of four children. My father has been a blacksmith, a plumber, and as far as I remember, he had a little vodka on his bench at all times. I remember being hungry, and I remember spending time with neighbors, most of the time in a rich neighbor's house. And when it came a time, or my puberty, or I don't know how to say it in English probably, at a certain age. But before I get to that age, I want to dig into my origin of my alcoholism. I was born on the street, South Street, in my hometown in a hospital, and the doctor, when I was born, the doctor grabbed me by my nose and he said, "It's a boy." And then a couple days later, somebody came with a razor and took away from me a little something and traditionally gave me the taste of little wine, and I started screaming my head off and crying, and probably because I wanted some more. And that's how I started wanting the wine. I started drinking at the neighbor's house. He had vodka, and I always went there after school. We started drinking, and I started liking it. We drank daily, and my family was, as I said, was not too well off financially. I remember my father was sitting in a bar a couple blocks away, and whenever a client came in, I would have to go to get him to bring him home. And I think it has a little something to do with my alcoholism, if there is such a thing as hereditary, which I don't know for sure, and I'm not medically educated. And I believe that the poverty was a result of my father drinking. Maybe yes and maybe not. I started drinking daily with my friend, and I didn't become a real lush yet at the age of 14 or 15. And then something happened to me that I once consulted my sponsor if I should use this part of my life into my story, and he said, "You should, because it's part of your life and part of your story." So I will mention to you a little period in my life which is very, very hard for me to talk about, because in 1939, Poland was invaded, and you know which, by whom, and I was locked up in a ghetto. And if you don't understand what that means, is like, let's say some invasion takes place in here, and they want to lock up all the Jews in one section, like Winter Park. That's what they did in my hometown. They put barbed wires around them and put us on a starvation diet, and shooting us down or doing anything they wanted, because we had no defenses, no representation, no country in the world. And so I was exposed to terror, and I really hardly can have the strength to go through describing those moments, but it's part of my life. And I wound up in a boxcar several months later, or 2 years later, after the ghetto. In the ghetto, I really lost my brother-in-law and my brother's wife and two kids. They were transported to Auschwitz. And in 1933, I believe it was, the second part of 1943, I was put in a boxcar, which, if you would like to have a little more vivid testimony, I was in a boxcar with another 100 people, skeletons-like, with a piece of bread on the trip to be shipped to a concentration camp. 7 days I was in the boxcar in a July. We stopped a couple of days, and at one stop I remember my teeth were knocked out, because I made an attempt to get some water. And when we arrived in a infamous concentration camp, Buchenwald, most of the people were, I think, half dead or dead, and some still alive, especially the young ones, like my age was 19 of them, or 20. And so I was in Buchenwald, near the gas chambers, and all I can tell you about those days is that where the Nazis to the devil, their souls have sold, where the bloodthirsty beasts committed crimes yet untold, behind electric barbed wires, starving and cold, I lost my best years and suddenly grew old. I survived as a result of you people's American army, the couple of weeks marching from Germany to Czechoslovakia at the end of the war, because they tried to eliminate the confrontation with the Americans or the Russians, and they shouldn't find this heap of garbage that we turned out bones. So that, I don't know for what reason, the same as we say in AA, but only by the grace of God, I was alive November 1945, May the 5th, And I was liberated in a small town in Czechoslovakia called Praslitz. In that little village, there was a prisoner of war, Russian prisoner of war, and they were liberated too, and I don't know how or where or how they made it, but they had vodka the same day. As a skeleton as I was, they offered me a can, one of those empty ration cans, and I gulped it down on a shrunken stomach, and because, you see, I am totally convinced that the alcoholism is a disease, and it's a progressive disease, and I didn't drink all those years when I was incarcerated, but the alcoholic's progression took place, and I gulped it down as soon as I had my hands on it. An alcoholic doesn't drink, as you probably know that. An alcoholic gulps. We don't drink a little cocktail and put it down with that one finger pinky sticking out. We just take a glass and down it down. And so I did it, and I was about 6 or 7 months in the hospital, I don't remember. But somehow, by the grace of God again, my health returned. Then they put a little meat on my dried out bones, and I started realizing I lost 35 people of my family. And I started suffering from that fact, because I couldn't understand why I survived and my father didn't, and so far. But the alcoholic me found myself immediately a way of drinking, and I don't remember ever since liberation, or since I recovered from the hospital, ever drawn a sober breath from the day I was liberated until the day I stopped drinking. And when the miracle took place, I'll share it with you, was November the 3rd, election day in the Bronx, New York, 1970. For some unknown reason to me, I have never taken a drink since, so I don't know. There's a lot of people that have experimented, and I don't know why, but God was good to me. I didn't find it for necessary to pick up a drink since. But I fell in love with AA. Let me go back to my story. When I came to the United States of America, because they passed a bill in the Congress that to admit 200,000 refugees or survivors from Europe, and I came to New York, to the Bronx, and I was unfinished education, and I didn't have a profession. And so, but the egomaniac and this alcoholic in me has chosen a profession subconsciously to be near the booze, and that was to be working in a restaurant or a hotel or nightclub. I became a busboy in the Hotel Roosevelt in 1945. When I got here in the end of 1949, 1950, I used to go to work at 5 in the morning to set up the tables as a busboy, and I spoke six languages, and one of the managers was Italian, and Italian was one of my languages, because as I skip my story, which I'll retract now, I lived in Italy for 5 years after the war, and that's where my alcoholism showed up real clearly. I acquired a wife from the refugee camps too, and she was a survivor from Auschwitz. And my son, I was born in 1947. I was a full-fledged alcoholic, sitting in the streets of the side cafes in Italy, drinking vermouth by the quart. They used to call it mezzo litro, red vermouth, white vermouth, and I have not had I had no reason to work, because I was supported those days by the United International Organizations, and I had a place to live, and so I was just drinking on a daily basis quite a bit. I remember my son had this celebration of what I told you about before called circumcision. I was puking all over me already, and I was quite advanced in my drunkenness. So as I told you a moment ago, I came to the United States, and I started working in the restaurant business. I was working at the Hotel Roosevelt as a busboy for the morning shift. If anybody here has an idea about restaurant business, is the breakfast, lunch is the toughest shift. So I had to go in the morning and set up tables. But I couldn't get to the bar yet, because I was only a busboy. But when I was promoted after a while to a waiter, my real glory started. Now I met the guy called the bartenders in the service bar, which is behind the dining room in every place, and over there I used to make a deal immediately with any bartender, hand him some cigarettes or a couple bucks, and he would give me some drinks to sneak to for myself. While I was putting up some drinks for the dining room on my fingers holding a little round cocktail tray and a napkin over my hand, I'd always had a shot in my palm. And then I would go back to the service bar after I cleaned your table and down it down. And there, those days, I started to be interested in where does the next drink come from, and my life started to be possessed, obsessed, and managed by booze. My son was growing up in a home where there was 5 in the morning fights, arguments. He would sleep with a pillow on his head, not to hear father and calling mother all kinds of names. And I was becoming slowly but gradually but surely I was becoming a zombie. I hardly saw him growing up. My whole day was, night was only on one thing. Where do you get some extra money for drinks? And anybody else would come in my way, I would push him on the side. Things was getting home worse, from worse to worse, and I was getting worse in drinking. I never had enough job. The job was never enough. I always had to find another job. And so I went into caterings for weekends. And the catering, if anyone has any idea from drinking days, catering is the best place to be when you're an alcoholic. Because there's 10, 15 tables all set up with bottles of rye and scotch and soda and ginger. And you serve the people properly. And we used to have jackets, and I always picked up a jacket a couple sizes larger. And there was big pockets inside. I'd take a glass from a table, fill it up with a couple shots while the people were dancing on a dance floor. And I'd go inside in the service area and gulp it down. But the best time of a waiter in a catering house is when the bride leaves after she throws away her bouquet and everybody is jolly happy and they leave, and the big catering hall is full of tables with full of glasses and unfinished bottles of rye or bourbon or scotch and some red wine or white wine. And we were supposed to clean up the tables, and so we did. I always associated with a couple guys that liked to do it the same way as I did. And we would have parties going. And what I would do is we take off the glasses into the, where we're supposed to take the dishwasher, put up some big tumblers there, and everything goes. We would put in the leftover whiskey sour, rye, scotch, gin, vodka, whatever, and make big tumblers of booze, big tumblers, and we had parties. And sometimes we added a little red wine, a little white wine, and then some trays would start dropping on the floor, and we would break up a lot of things. And the boss overlooked those things because he cared less, because what is there? He's paying us very little, and besides, the wedding has paid already for all the booze. So I was always cockeye drunk by 5 in the morning, trying to come home. And during the week, I was looking for other jobs, and my job started getting shaky. And I remember that His Majesty the Baby, that's what I was, I was looking for the best job in the New York that can be found. And if you believe it or not, there was a nightclub in New York, was the most famous nightclub in the world, and it was called the Store Club. And I wound up working there as a waiter and then as a captain of waiters. And I wasn't even satisfied with that, because day and night, all I was concerned about is before I got to work, I was drinking. I lived in the Bronx then, and I was stopping always to have a few martinis, vodka martinis on the rocks, because you see, I never wanted to have any vermouth, and I would tell the waiter, the bartender, just a dash, and don't put any ice because it takes up room, and don't put no olive because it takes up space, and then the vodka martini on the rocks got glued into my hand, and that's all I lived with. One little piece of ice. As a matter of fact, I was telling somebody this morning, I didn't write to my brother that lives in Israel for 20 years. I didn't write a letter to him. And the reason for it, because I couldn't get a pen between my fingers. And in my fingers, I had to have this space for my drink. So I couldn't, who would bother writing letters? And then I was starting to be hygienically neglected. Ooh, what a nice word. for my poor English. I will tell you what I did with what's very, kind of very, very embarrassing it would be to think about it. I was wearing a tuxedo and black shoes and black socks and ruffled shirts. That was my outfit most of the time where I worked. And I had to wear black socks, and the socks would get once in a while holes in, on the heels. And those days I already was not in speaking terms with my wife if I still lived in the house, because we had many occasions when not living together. And because I used to be given the outside of the house most of the time, and she kept the inside. And I was ripped those socks the back of the on the heel, and not taking shower for a long time, the holes would show my broke my dirty heels. So I invented pushing the sock inside, and you know, lowering the sock. And because it came a time I didn't have no socks to wear there. Anyhow, this is just to describe you how negligent I was becoming about my own self. And then I even stopped eating normally because it's a part of our disease. And I would like to tell you now that I mentioned this part of the disease, we have, it's a threefold disease. It is spiritually, mentally, and physically. And spiritually, I was dead when I was 7, 8 years old because I started making fun of the people that go to synagogue. Like going with my father to synagogue and standing there and listening to the people praying Hebrew, which is a language that I understood because I was going to Hebrew high school. And I couldn't figure out what they do in this praying and this all this thing. And I started making fun of it. I was too smart. A typically alcoholic, I know everything, and I had no spirituality, I had no feelings for faith or religion or nothing. And then mentally, when I was all drunk, I did beautiful things like knocking down the doors. The time came when I was yelling and screaming at my wife. If she let me in like 5, 6 o'clock in the morning after I got out of the sewer, I called myself like a rat in a sewer those days where I lived when I was drinking that way. I was coming home with bloodshot eyes at 5, 6 o'clock in the morning out of a subway in New York, and the sun would hit me, and it was horrible. And then I was, the smell of some bacon and eggs coming out from a luncheonette or something would turn your stomach. And I would break down the door if she didn't let me in. If she didn't let me in, she would try to say good morning or hello, and she tried to kiss me. I would get very wild, and I'd say, well, you're trying to smell my breath on me. And if she ever forgot to try to do that, I'd say, you don't love me no more. I believe that my wife had a wire attached to the doorknob, because every time I put the key in the door, the light at her night table in her bedroom would get off. So I yelled at her that she might have made some fix, and we had a conversation at 6 in the morning when my son was about to leave for school. I would scream and yell at her, who was here the night before? Was the painter here? Was the superintendent here? Who did you receive? And they're doing this and that. And then I started screaming, yelling, where's my food? And she'd give me some food. And my wife reminded me long after that I had a plate of spaghetti glued to the wall, and she left it there for quite a few months. I mean, the signs and the whole garbage. You see, my wife went to Al-Anon 10 years before I ever heard of it. She said that I was calling this fellowship American Airlines. That she used to bring home brochures. I don't know if you ever come in touch with a black belt or Al-Anons, God bless them. She saved my life, but she was bringing brochures home, putting them on the coffee table. And the whole trick was, if I would look at them about AA or meetings, she would check it out later. If the book was a little turned or the brochure was a little turned or missing, she would be very happy that I looked at it. But usually I took the brochures plus yelling and screaming and flush it down, you know where. But the message was the seed was planted. Because I do totally believe that the seed of AA takes. You see, there's like you see a farmer planting some grain or something, throws out thousands and thousands and millions of seeds, but only if some take. I believe that the seed of AA, the message, takes only on a pile of manure. When you're really in a mess, like I'm describing to you I was, when you're really starting to demolish your family life and your jobs, speaking of jobs, I wound up going to a place in New York called the Waring Avenue, where there was a, the pool, what do you call it, labor pool. And I'd go every day to another job already. And before that, I worked there for quite a while. I worked in Mama Leone's. You must have heard of that place. And I did the same thing. As soon as I finished working, I'd sell my tables. I don't know if anybody here that knows the restaurant business a little. I'd have 5-6 tables to serve. I'd give it to somebody else and say, collect it for me from the guests. And I had to hit for Broadway because I had to make it in time for the last call to line up a bunch of drinks for the chef, for the other waiters, because I believe that I got to buy them all so they're going to be my friends. And sometimes I come home and I forgot that I made $80 or $70 in tips and came home with empty pockets. And so there, I cared less if there was any food in the house or milk in the house. That's the way it was. I have to admit that. And I made a mess out of my life and my jobs, and rather I would say that the booze did it to me. I would hang out in a little place in the Bronx called the Bucket of Blood. It was a little Italian corner place where I used to hang out most of the time because it was not too far away from home. I could walk in distance. So I'd sit there and have my martinis before going to work when I could take the subway, when I could still do more or less a few hours work. And on the way back, I'll always go there. I remember sitting there when I was offered a job in Mama Leone's. Some wine company came up to me and said, we noticed that you are a fantastic captain, because I was in charge of waiters already at that time, and the boss in Mama Leone's would give out a bottle of Anisette to pass it out to the guests after their meal with their black coffee with the espresso. I was supposed to give everybody a little bit, but we had that partition there on the side where we kept those bottles, and I kept my coffee there just for the color. And I was using the Anisette for myself a whole night. One day, Jim Leone, the owner, tasted it, and he almost passed out. And so I kept on drinking even on the job, and I'm sure it wouldn't last too long. And so in that Bucket of Blood in the Bronx, I was sitting there for hours. And while I was trying to tell you, in Mama Leone's, a company, a wine company, and that used to import the Galliano cordial, and they came over to me and said, how would you like, and I'm listening, how would you like? You are such a good man on the floor. You speak language, 6 languages. You're going to be fantastic. Would you like to be a liquor and wine salesman? I said, sure. Well, I couldn't get a better offer. And I immediately imagined that my car is going to be packed with cases. And as a matter of fact, I had a lot of samples. Came a holiday season like now, for example, and I was supposed to go to the stores and show them, the bartenders and the store owners, show them the nice new bottle of Four Roses or Fleischmann or something, and the new packages, and I was supposed to let them taste it. But I did show them all the bottles, but I never let them taste it because they were empty already. And so I was collecting knick-knack little bottles, miniatures in the house. I had them on a little shelf in a corner. My wife had shelves of them. And I would fill them up with the ones that had scotch or rye, I'd fill them up with tea. And the vodka and gin, I'd fill them up with water. And then none of them had anything in it. There was about 50 of them. And when I got sober, my wife told me this revelation. I say, did you ever know? She says, yeah, sure. I said, how did you know that there were not any booze in there? She said, all the seals were broken. She got smart, too. Anyhow, I was going from bad to worse. I was on my way to the cemetery for drunks in the Bronx. I was becoming a zombie. I hardly spoke to my son or saw my son grow up. And if anyone here has any kids and you're sober, cherish it and enjoy it. And so I have gone all the way I could go because I started having trouble with the old lady for real. And she succeeded to throw me out a couple times. And I lived there a while in a flop house. A flop house, one of those little rooms where they had a cot to lay down and a white bulb with a string. And sometimes I missed the cot when I came polluted in the house and in that place. And I used to beg myself on the phone, please let me come home, let me come home. She had a tough Irish sponsor, I have a name of Mary, and she told me point blank, if you ever get sober even, you ain't going to come home before a year. And so I went up to the subway there, there was a railroad station where I lived, and the subway would go down making a lot of noise, and had a telephone booth, and I called up, and I said, oh, I'm going to come home, I'm going to jump in the train. You say, jump and hang up. And so I was really going down the train, going down the tube. And not only that, I was waiting when I made a phone call. I was waiting by the train to arrive, you know. Anyhow, I started playing games with the cops because my wife really couldn't take it much longer, and she has called the police. She called the 47th precinct, and she kept calling them twice a day, three times a day, and I believe that the cops knew her voice better than their own friends because she constantly was on the phone with them. And they started waiting for me. I'd come home early in the morning or 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and then I would go up to the door, and the door would be a latch and wouldn't let me in, and I hear her screaming for the cops behind the door, and I'd break the door with a crowbar, or if I couldn't do that no more, I hear the elevator coming up, it was a sixth floor, or third floor. My wife was once sitting when I was speaking, and I said sixth floor, she yelled at, no, third floor. Anyhow, whatever floor it was, when I heard the elevator come up, I have run down through this, where it says exit, through the stairway, and I beat the cops. They came up with the elevator, I went down with the stairway. And one of those days, it happened as was expected, there was a reception committee when I ran down this stairway, there was two other cops waiting for me. And so I wound up in the Tombs in New York, downtown New York. They have a place there, maybe you saw Kojak once on TV, he was operating from there. I think Barney Miller works from there too, down below the New York. They had in the main jail down there. And they took me down there. One thing I couldn't understand is one of the cops, an Italian fellow, used to drink with me in the same bucket of blood with me in the Bronx. And there he was with the badge on, with the uniform. Say, Leo, I can't help it. You got to go. And so here I am. And now I hope that you will understand that what I'm saying here, if there are anybody here who ever was in jail, because I will never, ever, ever forget that sound, that clang of the metal door when they ask you cordially to go in there. They talked nice to me, and I kept on yelling, who do you think you're locking up? You know who I am? I'm His Majesty the Mayor. I'm speaking six languages. I work for Jean Leone in German Billingsley. And they didn't listen to the Majesty the Baby. They locked me up just the same. I still had, I think, a little pint on the back of my pen somewhere in there. And I look at the cot, a little wooden cot, and I said, me? No, I wouldn't sleep here. You gotta be kidding. And somehow they walked away, and I yelled, I screamed, kept yelling, and they didn't care. I think one of the guys yelled, gringo back and quiet or something. Anyhow, I spent the night in that jail, and this is where my story of woe ends almost. In that jail, the message of AA, the seed that my wife planted about AA, she used to tell me, there is a name of a man, here's the card. If you ever want him, his shoes are by his bed, always in his pants ready. Anytime he'll come and he'll talk to you. Anyhow, I didn't listen. She was going to Al-Anon for quite a while already. And I didn't listen, but that night in jail, something happened to me. And this is how I describe the miracle of AA usually. It, like that song, it only takes a moment. And that moment of truth was like you take that plug and you plug it in and there's electricity. Like a one lady, there's a lady that comes to meetings, said once in the Odette Club, I believe. She said when they turned off her lights and she lost because she didn't pay the bill, she couldn't pay the bill, she wasn't a mess, like at the end of her drinking days, she says, and when the lights went out, the light in my brain went on. When they put me in that jail, that message of AA suddenly came to me. What are you doing in jail? You are not in a concentration camp in Germany. There are no Nazis around here. What are you doing in jail? You became an American citizen in 55. You're in a free country. Why are you in jail? And the answer came from someplace, maybe by a long shot, that little old witch has a point there. Maybe you drink a little too much. Maybe it has something to do with your booze. So the message came to me, and the next day I went out, and I don't know if I drank again that same day or not. I know one thing. I know that I was making a phone call from that flophouse, asking the operator for AA, and I spoke to somebody, and next day when I came out of a daze from my drunkenness or blackout, which I experienced quite a few, I remember once looking for my car for hours and hours and hours, and I went out from that flop house and I started looking for the car and went around about 100 blocks for 2-3 hours, and when I came back and gave up on it, I found the car in front of the same place and same building, but it was on the left side. And I done things like this many a times. So I have reached a moment and called AA, and I don't know if I remembered or forgot about it, but a couple hours later or next morning, I heard a voice say, and the phone was ringing, "Did you call AA?" I say, "Yes, and we had taken you off their tape." I didn't know I was talking to a tape and to a box, and anyhow, it must have been that weekend or something, and I started to act the big shot, and where is the meetings? And they told me a gratitude group is meeting at 8 o'clock, St. Raymond's Church on East Tremont in the Bronx. I went to my first meeting. Here's the miracle of my resurrection, if you don't mind me using that word. This is when the Leo in the Bronx died. This is where I buried him. And I was reborn into a new person. I hope to believe that I did change since I got to AA. I got to that meeting, and a miracle happened at that first meeting to me. I sat down at a long table, and there was quite a number of long tables. They are a big, big meeting, the gratitude group. And next to me was sitting a gentleman, and he was, I was curious, you know, big mouth. What is this all about? I say, how about, ba 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 ba. And this man answered me. When he talked to me, he sounded with such a horrible accent that I sounded like an Oxford professor compared to him. He had a very heavy accent. I say, where are you from? He says, from Warsaw, Poland. Believe it or not, it's immediately worked for me. Because this Polak, we started speaking Polish, he became my angel. He took me home, and the wife started feeding me a little minestrone. She was Italian. And he was taking me to meetings day after day after day. He became my first sponsor. Being the kind of a negligent person I am, I know he lives in Miami. I hardly correspond with him now, but that's another character detail I didn't get rid of yet. I have another sponsor sitting there with his wife. And so I have started recovering. And I started going to meetings, and I fell in love with AA. I fell in love with AA, and miracles started happening to me. A few miracles that happened to me, I would never believe that it can happen. And so I lived in the Bronx. I started going to work. It wasn't so easy. I tried to be a salesman. It wasn't so easy. Because instead of stopping in bars, I started stopping in restaurants to drink coffee all day from between one call and the other. And finally, I went back to the profession that I had already acquired, which been working in restaurants. And I started recovering. And my wife kept her promise that you ain't coming home before a year. After a year, she gave me gracious permission to return. But due to a complication that I created in my drunken days, and the complication was a very simple one, I fell in love with a very buxom, strong, smiling Italian lady that had a rolling bar in her house. That was when I was separated. She had a rolling bar, stacked to the gills with booze. I fell in love with that. That was my drinking. And that came, it was like a shadow after me for quite a while. And I made a decision quickly. I'm going to leave New York behind me, everything. I'll leave my wife, my girl, and everything. And I'll start a new life. But somehow kept going to AA and came to believe that my inner guts are screaming out to try to repair the things that in my drunkenness caused me to do. And I severed the relationship and decided to renew my marital status and begged my wife to come down here. She's now down in Orlando with me. And I've been in Orlando since 1973. And I have been to Elko Inn Club on Jackson Street. It was my first group. And I told them the first meeting I went to, I said, I am not from the South, but I decided, I'm not even a Gentile, but I decided to stay in AA if you like it or not. And a couple guys left. They really had fun. And so I started in the Elko Inn Club, and I feel like it's a homecoming for me to be here. It's sure a privilege and an honor to be here. And I kept going to meetings nonstop. And I got the job. I was sitting on the bench there. There was a bench in the other Alcoyen Club. And I was sitting there day and night, and I didn't feel like going to work until a mailman came by, God rest his soul. Murray was his name. And he says, you're going to sit here? You ain't going to work? He said, you got to go to work. Until you'll be 65, nobody's going to give you nothing. And so go to work. And I started looking for work, and I got myself a job in the Mickey Mouse factory. And they had no job for me because I was overqualified, spoke many languages. I was then already an established maitre d' from New York and speaking all those languages, and say I couldn't get a job. And I kept on insisting. I was enthusiastic. And finally they gave in and say, well, I got only one opening here, but it pays only $2.50 an hour. I don't think you want it. I said, who told you? And so I took the job. I started out in one of the hotels, and in a couple of weeks after they observed my abilities, that I walked around the floors trying to sell a couple of glasses of wine to individual customers, and they made me an offer, and I grabbed it. It was, instead of making $100 a week, they doubled it, and I was became a supervisor, and I didn't stop working until I have reached 12 and a half years with him, and I retired. And got myself a pension. Mickey sends me every month a nice check. And all you people who are in this room tonight and still make a living and work, and if you see somebody taking off a few dollars from your paycheck for Social Security, I thank you. I'm getting it. I appreciate it. I appreciate that very much. So these are the miracles that happened to me in sobriety. I don't know if I've done anything for anybody or to, but I do feel every room I go into, everywhere in this town. I have been today in three clubs. You might say, this guy is really still sick. I started out with a Rebo's club in the morning. I went to the Odat in the afternoon, and I invited a couple guests to come to listen. Yeah, I am a very humble person. I have invited guests here. And so I am doing quite well now. And I don't know if you got any message out of what I had to tell you, but I was down and out as a result of being addicted to this alcohol, due to the fact that I have an alcoholism disease. I am very fortunate to have made many friends. I have a little guy peeking at me here. The good Lord bless him. He loves me. I know it with all his heart and soul, and I love him. And if I wouldn't even go into a detail to tell you the circumstances we met in, the conditions that we met at. And I have hundreds of people in this town that I remember their day one in AA. And if you have never experienced it, I will tell you, there's no greater blessing. There's no money that can pay for it. To see a guy the first meeting or a girl tearful, all shook up, all nervous, Charlie is smiling too at me, and then see them doing fine, doing better, and so on and so forth. That is the most. If there is such a thing as a Christmas, which I wasn't brought up in that, but if there is such a thing, I will just tell you a little story. There was a guy in a cab in New York once, and he asked the cab driver, take me to Christ Church. And that guy takes him in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue. And he says, here it is. He said, well, this is not Christ Church. He says, if he ain't here, he ain't no place. And this is what I'm trying to say in reference to this room and this specific evening. I'd like to tell you a few more jokes. I would like to cheer you up. I'd like to speak for another hour and a half, but I think my time is almost up. So I will use a little poem that I once wrote to conclude my little talk. I will tell you the God honest truth. I am overflowing with the feeling of love. And if that's spirituality, I got a little bit. I wish sometimes I had hands that could embrace the whole world and hug them and bless them and help them and kiss them. And I wish that I had a magic baton that I could just do like the, you know, that somebody in the Vatican does, you know. I wish I had that and make everybody, your problems disappear. But there's one thing I like to tell you and guarantee you. I could sign for it. If you don't drink, you can't be drunk. That must have been Einstein that said a beautiful thing like this. It's so simple. If you don't get drunk, you don't go crazy. That's the second step. If you let it happen, God is going to take care of it. If you write yourself down your problems, you'll see where you're at. And if you have something very complicated, like a thing that I mentioned about the girlfriend and wife, I should have taken it to my sponsor who's sitting there or somebody else. But you can do that with anybody you want. And there's you're at the fifth already. And then the character defects and shortcomings, I still have some. But maybe I'll die with them. Maybe they'll take it off before I get into the St. Peter's office. I don't know. But then the amends, I have had to make amends, and I really thought I had a tremendous list of amends to make, and I never knew I don't have that much power. There wasn't that many people around that I really kicked that much. My son, I got a little adjusted with. My wife, that's about it. And then I have tried to make an amend to, and I have one that is still very, 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 very tough. And my wife, my sponsor's wife, she knows what I'm talking about. I have an irreparable amend, and I'm still trying. I'm still trying. And then if I insulted somebody, I instantly apologized. You know, I'm at the 10th step. And meditation at 11th, I try to do it as often as I can, especially that I'm getting a little young, a Hebrew prayer. And so I am doing my steps to the best of my ability. About the 12th, I can't tell you, but I already told you I'm a very humble guy. But I do not let a guy get by me after a meeting if he seems like or says that he would like to talk. I lay on them layers and layers of love. And I try to tell them how wonderful and what a hope there is if you're going to have the best Christmas you ever had in your life. I told the guy the other day, without any strings attached, take your hat off. He was wearing one of those caps. Take your boots off. Take off your feet from the table. Go and get a haircut. Buy yourself a little Christmas tree in your trailer. And don't talk so much. You could have gotten killed in normal society, probably. And he was a real hillbilly, Tennessee Mountain, I think. And he loves me, and I'm crazy for him. I saw him today. He used to himself initials on JC, let's say. I say, your name is Joe. He's Joe now. And he's smiling, full of smiles and full of hope and full of glory. Now, can I get a check here that could match a thing like this? Never. Never. And I have the good fortune of having hundreds of brothers, sisters, and sons and daughters in this town. I don't know why I'm so lucky, but I am. I just feel that when I go into this girl's place, this girl is another love girl, and I went from the Denning Street, we had a meeting going there. You know, you go to that house, you bless your face forever that you're sitting now with both hands and both legs functioning. There are so many thousands of people in this moment that are on hospital beds. We are so fortunate. There will be so many tragedies and so many anxieties and disasters in so many places, even this holiday. And how lucky and fortunate we are to be here, nice and peaceful. If there would be such a thing of measuring spirit or spirituality, I think that you could hardly cut it with a knife in this room. Where the heck is there a party in this world with 60 people about when, listen to this silence. It's just like the story I told you. Even in some churches or synagogues, there ain't such a thing as what you feel here. I know what I want to say. I know what I feel. I just don't know how to use the words because I don't know if I've offended somebody or not. I couldn't spend a better holiday feeling than what I'm doing right now. I hesitated because people heard me before. I spoke before here. But by a long shot, if there's somebody there in some of the corners or somewhere in here, that the fact that I was a concentration camp inmate, the fact that I lost 35 people in my family, the fact that I have my wife back and my son talks with me and he's about to become a PhD and I might have to call him doctor, the fact of such improvement compared to the zombie that I was laying in a cot, on a cot or next to the cot in an empty room with a door never locked, that I was called Jesus Christ over and over and over. And you know how? Every time I showed up in that bucket of blood bar, the bartender would scream, Jesus Christ, you here again? I just want to cheer myself up a little bit. I'll add you one more ethnic joke so that I'll give equal time to the Jews. An Israeli ship was sinking, and the captain yelled out, "Don't sell the don't give up the ship. Sell it." And every time I come into a room in AA, and I go to many because almost everybody knows Leo around, because I go everywhere. And so every time I show up in a place, a guy would come over to me and say, "It never fails. Oh, I got a joke for you." Every time I come around someplace, they tell me a joke about the Jews. And I love it. I can tell it. So now I came to the conclusion why the Jews wandered 40 years in the desert with Moses. They found out. One of them lost a quarter. All right, I got 3 more minutes to go, and I will... Couldn't you imagine it would be a dollar? Now, this is what I like to have that come out of my talk that I should hear myself say, is put the emphasis on the spirituality. Because this is the basic of all the couple millions of people's miracle around the world in AA. This is love and spirituality. And if this holiday or any holiday is not all about, then we have a holiday every day. So I'll tell you why Christmas and Hanukkah and Thanksgiving is every day with me. Because I'm so happy today, I could cry. For no more am I a slave, condemned to die. I'm free and equal with everyone here. Forgive me, Lord, if I shed a tear while I praise you, great God, for saving my life, for giving me a son and a lovely wife, for the roof to live under, for the key to my door, for not knowing of hunger like I did know before, and for many more things, I sincerely thank thee for bringing me to this land of the happy and free. For sparing Americans from what I've seen and heard, for maintaining peace on this troubled earth. And above all, today, I thank you for AA.